change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, this is the Nonprofit Snapcast. Welcome. I am Mickey Desai, your host. I am happy to be speaking today with Sarah Simmons, who is the founder and director of Her Future Coalition. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good, Mickey. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, I'm glad we could do this. It was a weird set of circumstances that brought us together, but I'm glad it worked out. And I want to learn more about, well, obviously, Her Future Coalition, which correct me if I'm wrong here, but you do work across the globe, or at least in multiple continents, to stop human trafficking. Is that correct?
That is correct. I guess you could say we work on the other side of the globe, in India, Nepal, which is sort of a global hotspot for all kinds of slavery, and specifically child sex trafficking, which is the area that we work on. And we work with survivors and girls at very, very high risk, trying to give them all the tools that they need to get out of an exploitative situation and to remain free forever.
Right. There's so many things I want to ask you, but why did you choose this subject matter area, and how did you get started in India and Nepal?
Well, I wouldn't say I exactly chose it, Mickey. I would say it landed on my head like a piano pushed out of a third floor window, and I was walking underneath it. Uh-huh. It was more like that. I had a completely different career as a songwriter for film and TV. And through that work, I found out about this issue at a documentary film festival, and was just really, knocked over isn't even the word for it. It just devastated me. It was a life-changing moment to find out about that this was happening and happening to such vulnerable girls. And the movie, the documentary I saw, focused on the trafficking of Nepali girls to the brothels of India. And so that was my first exposure to the issue. And that's where I started working, and it's where it took root, and where we continue to work to this day is in Nepal and in some of the cities of India, like Kolkata, where the girls are taken. Mm. We also work with a lot of girls who are Indian nationals and who've been trafficked, within their own country, and with second generation kids who are born into brothels and into second generation prostitution, and trying to offer a different option for them and give them, some resources so that they can have a different kind of life.
My goodness. So it sounds like very heavy work. I'm sure it's very rewarding, but I mean, there's, again, many questions to ask. Now that we know how the piano landed on your head, what exactly is the scope of what the coalition does? What do you guys do? And the second follow-up question to that is, isn't it risky?
Mm-hmm. So many questions in there.
Yeah.
So what we do, I didn't say this before, but we started in 2005. So we're about to turn 16. Ooh. In January. Uh-huh. And exciting. And over the years, it's really evolved. We started out working on economic empowerment for survivors, so that those girls that were rescued would have a means to move out of shelter homes, support themselves, and rejoin society in a safe way, where they could be independent and protect themselves. And then over the years, we saw the need for more shelters where girls could be safely housed, and especially those that are rescued at a young age could grow up and spend their entire childhood and teen years in a nurturing environment where they can reach their potential and recover from the extreme trauma that they've gone through. And then finally, education, which is actually our biggest program, because it is the best way to get out of trafficking and to rejoin society and kind of break the cycles of poverty and slavery that these girls face. So we've worked with about 4,000 girls over the years, women and girls, and mm-hmm. a few boys. And this year we're working with about 1,000 girls. Our main thing is it's long-term and it's intensive. We're not about dropping in and offering a workshop and saying, we serve that person. Our model is very long-term, multi-year. A lot of the girls have been with us for 5 years, some 10, because they were rescued at a young age and, as they're growing up, we want to make sure we walk alongside them as long as it takes for them to be able to stand on their own feet.
Sure. So you really are about interrupting an actual cycle, but again, that takes me back to my next question. Is this that kind of risky? I mean, there's some people out there who stand to lose a lot of money because of the work that you're doing. Is that not a fair statement to say?
It can be dangerous, and definitely, has to be done with care and mindfully of the situations, but we, when we're working, you know, directly in a red light area, we have a lot of support from local organizations and from the local community. The first thing, you know, if you want to work in an area like that, you've got to do is build that, build those relationships of trust so that you have people who've got your back. I mean, literally, you know, walking into a red light area, you know, on my own as a, you know, 5'9" blonde woman, it would, you know, obviously be an NGO person, right? Right. Obviously be a nonprofit person, and people would be seen as threat. But if I'm flanked by, you know, three boys and six women from the community, nobody's going to mess with us. So, you know, it's about having those relationships and building them and building trust, you know, with everyone in the community, including the traffickers and pimps that, you know, we're running a program for children here. It's, you know, we're not interfering with you. We're not police. We're not bringing the police. You know, we're running a drop-in center for kids to be safe and, or, you know, offering some alternatives for women who've maybe aged out of prostitution. And so, you know, while they may see it as a slight threat, we don't go head to head. It's not our role. We're not doing raids or, you know, bringing the police in. And there are organizations that do that and are much higher risk. Mm-hmm. A lot of our work is also not done in the red light area. It's done in rescue shelters, which are, you know, have protected with armed guards and a big giant, you know, iron wall and gate, because otherwise traffickers would come and steal the girls back immediately. And even as it is, they do try to get in and they throw phones in and they're, you know, try to get, you know, entice the girls to come out because they have lost the income and they know it. But because it is, you know, completely protected and guarded, and usually it's not in the city, it's the shelter homes are in somewhat remote rural areas. And not so remote that you don't have people around. So, you know, it's not too bad. There've been, all of us have had moments where we felt unsafe or a close call. Like one time I was at a shelter home, in rural, outside Mumbai, in a sort of rural area. And the police came in the middle of the night demanding to be let in because they wanted to exploit the girls. They were like, well, they're prostitutes. And, you know, they were just local police. And
my goodness.
That was really scary for all of us. And, you know, obviously we're all prepared to, you know, go to battle for the girls, but that wasn't a good situation. But eventually the person who runs that shelter came with bigger police, you know, more higher level, and put a stop to that.
Yeah.
There's, you know, there've been some moments, but we also work with girls in villages prior to them being trafficked. If they're in a village where a very high number of girls are being trafficked, or a sister's been trafficked, been identified as high risk. So those aren't, you know, necessarily dangerous situations. It's really just the two most dangerous things are, you know, I guess when you work in the red light area, and we mitigate that by working with local people and having our community organizers. And the most dangerous thing of all in working in Calcutta is getting in a car of any sort, anytime.
Yeah.
Super crazy.
Yeah.
And I mean, seriously, like the times I thought this is it and said my, you know, final prayers was not in the red light area. It was in a car. In
no
a taxi.
Kidding. Yeah. Oh, you mean because of the actual just traffic conditions?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. The reason I'm laughing is because my family is from the other side of the country in Gujarat. And there are basically two rules of traffic, and they are to stay as far to the right as possible or far to the left as possible and don't have any accidents. And those are the rules, right?
It's like right. And you know the rule, right, Mickey? Like where if you are in an accident, you run.
Yeah.
You've heard of that? Because like if you know, we've been in taxis where there's just like not even that serious of an accident, but you run because sometimes a mob will form and beat up the driver or even the, you know, occupants of the car.
Exactly.
So we were like, you know, I've been in cars with, you know, volunteers or maybe a donor, and there's like a fender bender, and I'm like, run. And they're like, what? Like, you're insane. We're not running. And I'm like, no, we are running right now. Run. It's just so crazy.
My cousins jokingly tell me that that's their version of traffic court. Whoever wins the fight afterwards is clearly the person who was in the right.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, it's crazy. But seriously speaking, though, like one time I was just trying to get to the airport to go home. And it was between Delhi. There was, you know, two airports, domestic and international. It was about 8 miles between them. And I got in the cab and there was this like giant like propane tank. And the guy was like, the driver was, I'm going to say 13 and high. And I was just like, I'm not going to make it. This is it. I'm never going to see my kids again. But anyway, I made it. I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, goodness. Wow. So why, I mean, I hear you say that the documentary you saw originally turned you to that corner of the world, but it's got to be challenging, you know, with your offices here in this country. I'm sure everyone's working remote right now. to affect a mission that is largely taking place, you know, on the other side of the planet, South Asia, that's got to be challenging.
It is. And I feel like, but I feel like it's a gift in that we had figured some of it out before COVID. So suddenly like everybody's working remotely and trying to solve that problem. And we did have the advantage that we've been, you know, always been working remotely. And so we had, you know, at least some things figured out, although we've learned a lot and grown a lot through this year. Initially the first couple of years, it was really hard because I didn't have my staff. I now have a staff of six in Calcutta. And so they are, you know, keeping things humming day to day. They're really leading the charge, and, you know, and we just kind of weave it together with weekly Zoom calls, and it's working very well. But in the early years, we didn't have any of those people. And working in collaboration with local organizations is a very important value for us. Always has been. I just feel like, you know, coming in with solutions is idiotic, B, kind of offensive. Mm-hmm. There is a very established anti-trafficking movement in India that started in 1949 with partition, and women who are, you know, trafficked, you know, with partition. And then again in the 70s, you know, when Bangladesh split off from Pakistan, and there was a huge influx of very vulnerable and trafficked women into Calcutta. So there's these organizations like All Bengal Women's Union that have been around since 49, working on these issues of vulnerability of women and sexual violence against women. And so I felt, you know, not coming in with someone who was a songwriter for film and TV from America and saying, here's how we're going to solve this, you know, would just be absolute hubris. So instead it was like, okay, what is working here for you guys? What do you feel, you know, you're great at, and what do you feel like you could use some support, you know, whether it's financial or mm-hmm. or resources of other sorts, how can I help? And everybody really responded well to that approach. And I found some incredible local partners, and without them, wouldn't have been able to do, you know, a quarter of what we've been able to do. It's definitely all been done thanks to some amazing local people who, you know, showed us the ropes, let us in, and gave us guidance on how we could be the most effective.
Right.
And that's just grown over the years. And now we have a group of six incredible partners in India and different parts of India, which is rescue shelters and drop-in centers and schools, and two in Nepal. And we still work really closely with all of them, as well as, you know, having some standalone programs run by our staff. So it's a sweet deal, and keeps, you know, makes it possible to be working remotely. Right. The part that's been really tricky is, you know, just India's a very bureaucratic country, and it has a lot of laws. It's kind of, you know, strict and also not always as organized as we wish it would be.
Right.
So that's presented a lot of challenges for us, just in terms of red tape. And, you know, just is a continuing challenge to kind of work within the system, and a system that's very different from what we have in America, and also, you know, not very much more bureaucratic.
Yeah. And I, you know, must say the bureaucracy over there is also culturally different than the bureaucracy that we have here. It's not that America has an absence of bureaucracy. I think we have plenty of it, but over there, it does seem to have a very different feel and a very different set of rules.
I mean, the thing that I learned when I, you know, because at first I was just frustrated with it. I'm like, you know, you just want one tiny thing, and you have to get like four different guys to rubber stamp it, like literally with a rubber stamp. And I'm like, what, you know, computers? Hello, this is India, like this technological center of the world. Like,
exactly.
Why is this happening, you know, with the rubber stamping? But then I came to understand, you know, this is a positive thing because of this employment, you know, through civil service is a huge employer. And, you know, you certainly wouldn't want to like replace those four guys in their rubber stamps with a computer, which could easily be done, but that would not be beneficial, you know, to society as a whole. So also coming into it, you know, with a little humility and be like, okay, there is a reason for this.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating. But you know, if things change, they need to change slowly and mindfully, and replacing people with computers while more efficient is not the answer either.
Right. No. And, you know, just speaking as an outsider, that's not quite an outsider, I think that it, you know, it certainly gives us an opportunity to honor people. I think that's what simply most folks want. And most civil servants in India, I think that's what they simply want, is to be able to, you know, to do their job and to be respected for it. And I think that's, for at least me, that's the observations that I've had whenever I visited the country.
Yeah, me too. And I feel like, you know, again, you can be really frustrated with them, but also they didn't create the situation.
Right, right.
They're just one of the four people with the rubber stamp. They're trying to do their job and, you know, like the rest of us get through the day. but it's tricky at times.
Yeah, that's right. So we've talked about what the coalition does. We've addressed some of the challenges you have happening over there in the country. We've even touched on COVID-19. You said that you'd already put some measures in place that made COVID-19 not really impact your operations so much, right?
Well, I definitely think, you know, in terms of our internally, it helped us because we always struggled with the fact that our issue felt far away, you know, to our wonderful supportive donors. Sometimes felt it was hard to keep donors engaged because it felt far away. It wasn't like something that, you know, like something like breast cancer that we all know someone in it, you know, it's interacting with the issue and people who facing the issue every day. Right. Well, it's not like that with trafficking, and it's not like that with trafficking that's going on in Asia. So we struggled with that, and we just never really realized or thought of the idea that, you know, you could have a Zoom call with, you know, some of the girls, you know, the older ones who come grown up in the program and are adults, and some of the staff over there and your donors, and you could just all jump on a Zoom call and talk. And we started, you know, these sort of, you know, fireside conversations in the spring, and everybody loved them. And it really, really re-engaged, you know, our donors, our community. It's everyone felt so connected and really, really supported our girls and staff because, you know, they were so isolated with, you know, as you know, a very long lockdown, 90 days or something, almost 90 days, strict lockdown. They were locked up inside. And
yeah.
These calls really encouraged everybody, you know, both sides of the Atlantic. So that was a very wonderful new thing. And then we had, you know, for our staff, we used to have these weekly staff meetings, but I don't know, somebody was always late and it was always, it just, you know, felt kind of chaotic. And with COVID, we were like, we have to make this our number one priority. No excuses. No, I'm busy with something else. I have to write this grant, blah, blah, blah. So we really recommitted to connecting with each other as a team. And we had a gift that one of our board members is a therapist, and she volunteered to facilitate our weekly calls so that we have a section that's business. And then we have a section of sharing, kind of group support, peer support that we give each other. It's been transformational for the team. We're all so much closer. We feel more supported. We've, you know, it's moved the work forward. And all of it, you know, wouldn't have happened without COVID. So I'm really thankful. So the other really wonderful thing that came out of this year for me personally and for the work was that back in April, one of the survivors that's come through our program and been in our sponsorship program for 8 years for education. Her name is Anjali, and she approached me about writing a book together about her story. And so that was our COVID project together. We did it over the summer through many Zoom calls, interviews with her, and also with the people that were involved in rescuing, repatriating, and helping her to heal. And so we wrote the book. It's called Standing in the Way. It's coming out January 11th on Amazon, and tells, you know, her story of being trafficked. It also talks a lot about the root causes and, you know, reasons that allowed that and enabled that to happen. And then the long process of, you know, being rescued. In her case, it wasn't a raid, and the amazing healers that kind of created these innovative ways and tools and, you know, ways of thinking that helped her to heal, helped her to return to Nepal, the shelter home that took her in and raised her, and all the teachers and all the people along the way who helped. And so it's a very, you know, very uplifting read, if I do say so myself. Mm-hmm. And we really try to, you know, break it down so people can understand, you know, how this happens and how we can all work together to stop it.
Yeah. What was the name of the book again?
It's called Standing in the Way, and Sarah Simmons and Anjali Tamang are the authors.
I'm going to make sure I put that in my show notes and link to it. But
thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This is fascinating stuff. I mean, you said you had a history in songwriting for television and movies. How did you learn the nonprofit game in order to do all this?
I had worked at a nonprofit in my 20s in New York City that worked with homeless youth through the arts. So I'd had some nonprofit experience. I'd never run one, and I'd never run one internationally. I'd never even been to Asia, so it was a little bit like crazy when I was like, "I'm gonna go to Asia." But I wasn't initially gonna go, you know, run a nonprofit. I was gonna volunteer for existing nonprofits, mm-hmm. and I did do that for a year, and then kind of got the idea of what I wanted to work on, which, as I said initially, was economic empowerment solutions. And I wasn't able to do that through the organization I was volunteering in because they didn't, that wasn't part of their work. So I started Her Future Coalition. And I learned along the way through many, many failures and some successes and, you know, some down moments and lots of bumps in the road. Lots of people helping me, and especially our local partners from whom I've learned so much and, you know, gained so much inspiration and support.
Well, no, and I'm glad to hear you say that you reached out to other nonprofits first to work with them, because I get a ton of phone calls from people who are quick to say, Mickey, I want to start a nonprofit. And, you know, 99 times out of 100, my answer is, okay, please don't do that.
Please don't do that. Yeah. Exactly. Like, and honestly, don't do it unless you like yourself want to like be totally broke, totally, right. You know, stressed out for a while. Cause you know, there were some years of that. Right. And, you know, we sold our house. We were fortunate and we had, my husband and I had some, you know, the means to sell a house and we sold our house and started the nonprofit that way. But you do need some kind of like seed money. Mm-hmm. And even with doing that, you know, that money ran out and then you don't initially have grants or donors very much. It's hard. Yeah. And I think, a lot of times it's not the most effective. There may be someone who's already doing it and you can bring your own resources to it and make it better. And if possible, you know, and like I say, in our case, we tried that and it wasn't the right fit for the organization that I was volunteering at. But, so I had to do it the hard way, but
sure.
You know, hey, it had its ups and downs. It's not the only, but it's certainly not the only way to be of service or even to create something. Cause I think you can create something new within something, or you can create something completely new on its own. You can do either.
Right. And you have to, you know, do your business planning and figure out if it's better to just fold your efforts into someone else's existing plan. As you said, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Sarah, collaboration's the key, right? Like whether you start your own thing or fold your thing into someone's existing thing, I think, you know, you've got, I feel like we're not going to move the needle on anything if we don't collaborate. You know, that is exactly right. The key, like, and especially nonprofits, because, you know, they're under-resourced or not quite enough funding or trying to solve the world's biggest problems. And you have like one, you know, thousandth of the money that's put towards, you know, trying to make phones better.
Yep, exactly.
They're already like so good. Like what more can you do? You know, I don't know, but you know, you're trying to solve literally like the world's biggest problems with, you know, almost some of the least resources of any industry.
Right.
And it's kind of ridiculous. So the only way you're going to do it is together. And by saying, you know, what are you guys doing? What are we doing? How can we come together? How can we help you? How can you help us? Yeah. And, you know, that constant and ongoing conversation of, you know, we're called Her Future Coalition because that's the piece of it, right? It's a coalition of people working in the field, our partners, us, our staff, you know, other organizations, that are doing other pieces of the work that we're not able to do. Like we don't work on legal, cases, you know, for survivors, or we don't do rescue raids, but other people do. And we try to support that just wherever we can. And I think that's the way. It's the only way. This is the way.
Sarah, I'm glad we could talk about this. If a listener should happen to have questions for you or want to learn more about Her Future Coalition, how would you suggest they get in contact?
Please check out our website, herfuturecoalition.org, and follow us on social media at Her Future Coalition.
Excellent. Sarah, thank you for making the time to do this recording with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was quite enjoyable talking to you.
Absolutely.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.